Today is the 26th of June, 2002, in the location of Koinonia Fireside. This evening, our presenter is Ingrid Christensen, and today's session number is CH1-2002-03, and it's titled Life Stories, Paths Untrodden, Perils, Session 3, The Death Penalty. Let's listen in.
I'm Ingrid Christensen. Welcome to this first of two sessions that I'm going to do on the death penalty. Tomorrow is more on the kind of ethical and moral issues involved and how our faith interacts with it. Today I'm going to frame up some of the public policy around it, and I'm going to tell you some stories, and I'm going to show you a little piece of video. Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg once said, "The deliberate institutionalized taking of human life by the state is the greatest degradation of the human personality imaginable." Although most developed nations in the world have abandoned the death penalty, the United States, which purports to be a leader in the protection of human rights, retains capital punishment. 38 states, the federal government, and the military provide for death as a punishment for certain crimes. Over 3,700 people are on death rows across the country. Executions have become routine in Texas, and the pace of executions is increasing throughout the country. The overall rubric or framework for my week is part of the Holden Prayer, which has the phrases in it down paths untrodden, through perils unknown. And I think that our discussion of the death penalty today will include human beings who have encountered perils, and I think that all of us are probably among them, and paths untrodden. So we're supposed to go out with good courage, and we're to remember that our God supports us and comforts us through our lives. So I just want to remind you of that as we talk about this difficult issue. I'm glad for the opportunity to talk about death penalty in this place. I've been doing work with the death penalty as a profession for about a year and a half, for almost 2 years now. And I've been dying to talk to Holden people about it, because this is where I get a lot of my bearings, my spiritual bearings. It's a touchstone for me, so I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it in this setting. What I do for a living is I'm a mitigation specialist. And what that means is all trials of people who are accused of crimes for which the state is asking the death penalty have three parts. One is the pretrial motions, and that's a legal matter that the lawyers deal with, a set of motions, whatever, clearing out a bunch of things before they can try the case. Then we have the actual trial, and then we have sentencing if we lose the trial. So because I only work on the sentencing part of the trial, the hope is that my work is in vain, that the client is found innocent and I don't have to do anything. I will have been working for a year on the case, but we hope that we win the case and I don't have to put on mitigation. But in the event that we lose the case, the mitigation has to be started, if it's a jury trial, the very next day, and if it's a bench trial, 28 days later.
When you say we, who is we?
I work for a defense lawyer, or a set of, in Illinois you have to have two defense lawyers, a first and second chair, in a death case. And in most of my cases I work for public defenders and get paid by the public defender. In one of my cases I work for the Northwestern University Legal Clinic and get paid by them. But in both cases the money comes from money that's been set aside by the Illinois State Legislature. And the reason for that, as some of you may be aware, is that Illinois has, since the death penalty was reinstated in the mid-70s, Illinois has put to death 12 people and has released as being completely innocent 13 people off of death row. So...
off of death row?
Yeah. Sentenced people. People sentenced to death, having gone through the whole process on death row, and then new evidence has arisen, like DNA, or somebody else confessing in a more plausible way.
And there's still a moratorium in effect, right?
In Illinois, there's a moratorium until January, when our present lawyer goes out of, I mean, our present governor leaves office, Governor Ryan. Both the candidates for his office are not committed to the moratorium. So in January, we're still piling them up on death row at this point, and in January, we may start marching them off. So it's, we feel some pressure in Illinois because we have, I guess I didn't put the number up there. I think we have about 300 people in Illinois who are currently on death row. The number grows weekly. So in the sentencing part of a trial, the state puts on what they call aggravation, and the defense puts on mitigation, and I'm the mitigator in some cases. The aggravation often consists of photographs of the crime scene and statements from the family, which is understandable and not bad aggravation.
The family of the victim.
Of the victim. Part of my job is to go, it's not a part of my job I have to do, but it's a part of my job that I'm choosing to do, is to go and do victim outreach, which is visit with the victim's family. That's sort of down the pike. I think I'll tell you first a little more about what I do. What I do to find mitigation is three kinds of things. I'm looking for three kinds of things. First of all, I go into the prison and sit with my client for as long as it takes, every 2 weeks, while he tells the story. So I pay attention to the client. I listen to him, I ask follow-up questions, I talk with him, and sometimes it's in sort of a dungeon in the bottom of a jail where there are leaky pipes and water on the floor and mice running around, and sometimes it's in a library, which is reasonably okay, and you know, each jail has a different setting. My commitment is to sit there until my client is done with whatever it is we're doing that day. So for example, a couple of weeks ago, I was sitting with one of my clients and I had given him an assignment 2 weeks earlier. He had been sort of casually mentioning in the course of telling me stories about his life, well, that person is dead now, or that person is dead now. This kid is 19 years old. And so I finally said to him, your assignment for next time I come is to bring a list of all the people you know who are dead. So 2 weeks ago when I went in to see him, he came with his little list. And he had 19 people on the list. He's 19 years old. I don't think many of us, when we were 19, knew well 19 people who were dead. So we sat and he told me that, I said, okay, tell me the story of each of these deaths. So he told me the story of those 19 people. And it took him 3.5 hours, and he wept and wept. And no one had ever listened to him talk about those. No one had ever let him breathe. No one had ever paid attention to those stories before. So I feel like there's something, I think when Jesus asks us to visit the imprisoned, Jesus has some good idea. I think those visits are just incredible. Every single time I go to the prison, I learn a tremendous amount. And I'm given a tremendous amount. And what I find is that my clients are as much interested in me as I am in them. I don't talk much about me, but and now and then I tell them a little bit because they want to know, do you have kids? What are your kids like? What are they interested in? Is your daughter still working in that neighborhood? You know, is she safe? Are you sure? Is that car going to keep going? I mean, they're human and they care and they respond to care with care. So it has to be a sort of a give and take. After I've spent time listening, I then follow up on the clues that I've been given. So I interview every family member that I can find out about, that I can locate. Sometimes it's tough to locate them, but I go to their homes and I sit and listen to them. And I sit for as long as it takes. So I hear the stories of the family from many different points of view. And of course I hear lots and lots of family secrets. And a secret will start to come out one place, and then I'll ask a few more questions, and it'll come out further in another place. I finally found out very recently that a client of mine who had been incarcerated at age 11 for a murder, and he was now had murdered someone else at age 19, that he hadn't done the 11-year-old murder. Nobody wanted to say that for a long time, but finally they said that over and over and over once the dam broke, because that kid had to take the rap for a murder that his older cousin had done, because his cousin, who was 13, would have been prosecuted as an adult. He had to do adult time, like 40 years. My client was only 11 at the time, and so he would only have to do youth time. Now I ask you, where is the justice in that? I mean, I can understand why the family system put pressure on this kid to cop to a murder he didn't do when he was 11, because it's better to do 5 years than 40. And in the family system, they do that for each other. But what's wrong with us? What's wrong with our justice system that would try somebody who was 13 for an adult crime? That's the part of it I didn't get. So anyhow, I do that follow-up. I listen to all that I can listen to. I talk to the school teachers, I talk to the pastors, I talk to anybody I can find, old friends. A client of mine, I went to see, and I said, I'm going to have to interview your mother and your dad and your brother and sisters. I said, so how can I find your mother? Do you know her phone number? And he said, well, she's in Division 4 of Cook County Jail. And then I said, how can I find your father? Well, he's in Division 11 of Cook County Jail. How can I find your closest friend? Well, he's down in Stateville. You know, it seems like everybody this kid knew was. So then I go to those places and interview them. Then I also get all the records. You know, I try to get the school records, the church records, the medical records, and the incarceration records of this person's life. We have a policy in Illinois of throwing away school records after 7 years. So there's been a new ruling by the Supreme Court last week that says that it's no longer legal in this country to put to death people who are mentally retarded. And there's going to be a lot of litigation to decide what that means. What is it to be retarded? What number do we use? 75, 70, 69, 65. But how do we prove it? And one of the ways to prove it, of course, is old school records. And we don't keep them. So what could save somebody's life is routinely thrown away. And the same is true with public aid records. Public aid storage facility has a policy of throwing out each set of records after 5 years by the month. As soon as 5 years has gone by, they throw them away. So anything that, if you wanted to document the income level of the family, for example, and telling the story, you wouldn't be able to do it through public aid. So that's something that's sort of an aside, but it concerns me. In this finding of fact, finding of story, listening to story, writing down story, paying attention to story, I'm looking for two kinds of things. I'm looking for stories of, they're all things that I hope will affect the jury's hearts, but stories of things that the client has done that are sweet or kind or lovely or, you know, that where the, or a pattern of kindness. So I want to be able to tell the jury or have people's voices tell the jury about that kind of thing. This is a human being who's done good things. The second kind of thing I look for is terrible things that have happened to this person. So I talk about all the bad things that have happened in the person's life, and I try to document as many of them as I can. And then the third thing that I look for is any sign of something that's diagnosable. So if there's a family history of alcoholism, does my client have it? How can I find out? If there's schizophrenia, if there's something bipolar, if there's something odd that I don't understand about the person. And then I can order testing. Illinois is very good. Illinois has this pot of money that can be used in the defense of people who are in capital cases because we've blown it so often. So we can have testing. We can do medical testing, and you know, I get paid, and anybody else that I need to hire can get paid to do these cases. So in Illinois, we really have a better system than in lots of states. Incidentally, I have all the statistics about all the states in this deck. I just printed it out from the U.S. Department of Justice website. So if you're curious about your state, how many people you've put to death, what method of putting to death do you use, how long does it take between arrest and death, all kinds of things you can learn about your state. You can come and paw through these sheets. So that's what I do. There are five ways that we still use in the United States to kill people. I've listed them on the board in red. They are lethal injection, which is by far the most common way, and I think most people would agree the most humane way. We do hanging, we do electrocution, we do firing squad still in this day and age, and we do the gas chamber. So there isn't uniformity across the states that execute people in the method used. There are 34 states that execute people. One of them, Illinois, is the only state that currently has a moratorium. I think 13 of them tried to get a moratorium last legislative season, and they all failed. So it's pretty ubiquitous. There are 3,000, in December of 2000, which is the most recent statistic I could find, there were 3,700 people waiting to be put to death. The number has, of course, gone up. It's going up exponentially every year at a faster rate. Although this number doesn't show that. 98 people were put to death in 1999 and only 85 in 2000. But I think 2001 was over 100, but I'm not positive and I don't have the number. 236 people were put to death between 1976. No, that can't be right. I think I should take that off of there. I think it's right.
Ingrid, you said exponentially increasing because there are more violent crimes or stiffer laws.
I think because people are more used to it. Juries are more comfortable with it. And there was a ruling yesterday by the Supreme Court that came in a newspaper yesterday, or maybe the day before, that that said that anybody who was sentenced to death by a judge when they didn't have a right to a jury, when they couldn't ask for a jury trial by state law, is now got a right to a new trial because that was illegal. The Supreme Court just ruled that was illegal. So that's going to affect, I think, 80 of the cases of people who are waiting on death row now. In Illinois, you have a choice, so that wouldn't affect Illinois candidates, but it would affect quite a few people in some of the southern states, I think, where judges had preempted the right of a jury to decide the sentence. I want to read you a piece that Stephen Bright, who's my hero in this field, he's a wonderful lecturer who runs this, he's the director of the Southern Center for Human Rights in Atlanta, Georgia. And he, this is a lecture he gave, and I'm going to quote you a few things out of there. The trend toward abolition in the rest of the world. The federal government in many states have expanded the use of the death penalty in the last 25 years, while the rest of the world has been abandoning it. In this country, the federal government adopted the death penalty in 1988. The federal government, not individual states. States started went back to the death penalty in 1976. But the feds did in 88, expanded it to over 40 crimes in 94, and restricted federal review of capital cases in 96. Many states expanded the crimes punishable by death and curtailed and expedited the review process. In Florida, for example, they've shortened I don't think that law passed. Florida has a real attempt to shorten the amount of time that it takes between arrest and death. And I don't think they passed a law, the legislature passed a law that said that it had to be limited to 5 years, and now I think they found the Supreme Court found that to be illegal. In the rest of the world, 35 countries have abandoned capital punishment since 1985. During that time, only 4 countries that did not have capital punishment adopted it. One of those, Nepal, has since abolished it. Only one other member of NATO, Turkey, has the death penalty. Turkey has not executed anyone since 84 and is expected to reverse its policy. 4 countries accounted for 80% of all the executions that took place in the world last year. They were China, Iran, the Congo, and the United States. Since 1990, only 6 countries have executed people who were under 18 at the time of the crime. Iran, Nigeria, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and in that rather undistinguished company, the United States leads by far in the number executed. So the United States is one of only 2 countries that have not ratified the International Covenant on the Rights of the Child, which, among other things, would prohibit the execution of people who were children at the time of their crimes. The other country is Somalia. So we're not in very good company.
Ingrid,
Vitor,
could you just comment on the news that are in the newspaper? There's a tide shift in the opinion on the American public regarding the death penalty, which I find it a bit suspicious that they're saying that that the public opinion is changing against that death penalty from the previous decade.
The public opinion that is changing, the way I understand the news reports last week, is changing that we should not kill people who are mentally retarded. That's what last week I heard on the news before I came here. Mm-hmm. That the public opinion in the United States is changing in that many states, I think 18 states, have outlawed killing people who are mentally retarded while they committed the crime. That's the only public opinion switch in the favor of less death that I know of.
And is deterrence still the main justification for it?
Maybe. It doesn't work. Deterrence has been proven again and again to have no effect on the production of crime in the future. So deterrence is not effective. Maybe some people believe it is. There is a growing dis-ease in the United States with the fact that there is a lack of fairness, however, and some people who are concerned in the sort of people in the justice community are concerned about lack of fairness. And the death penalty is certainly not imposed fairly. And the American Bar Association has called for a moratorium on capital punishment. It doesn't oppose death, but it has called on states to improve the quality of counsel assigned to the poor, to respond to racial discrimination in the criminal justice system, and to stop executing the mentally ill, the mentally retarded, and children. So the American Bar Association has gotten its way on that now, because mentally retarded are no longer supposed to be executed. One of the things that'll be litigated about that is, what about a volunteer, someone who's done so much ecstasy or PCB that they're mentally retarded, but they weren't when they were born? And I have no idea how that will play out, but it'll be sort of interesting to watch. Many states do not provide capable lawyers. And some states to defend those facing death at trial, and some do not provide counsel at all for the later stages of review. So it's actually possible for you to be on death row, be granted an appeal, to go to a higher level, and not be given a lawyer. And of course, when you're on death row, you don't have any money, so there's no way you can hire a lawyer. One of the reasons that people are really troubled by the death penalty is that so many innocent people are being sentenced to death. The over 90 people have been released from death row since 1976 because they were innocent. I just find that astonishing, that they could have gone through since 1976 when we started, when we restarted using the death penalty as a country. We had a suspension on it in the country for a few years before that. So there are lots, you'd think that with all the gravity of the crime, that people would not get sentenced to death unless they were truly guilty. The strongest mitigator for a jury is residual doubt. A jury listens to the trial and then they think, you know, I'm not quite positive. And the second strongest mitigator is remorse on the part of the person. I'm sorry, I did a terrible thing. And of course, if the person's innocent, they don't have access to remorse. So those are, this client is a client of mine, Leroy Orange, who I will show you a little video about later. And Leroy was sentenced to death in 1984. And he's been on death row ever since then. He's accused of having killed four people, including a 9-year-old. His confession was extracted through torture, which he's described in some detail. And he has now been granted a new sentencing hearing. But the sentencing hearing is so, the mitigation for the sentencing hearing is so affected by the fact that he can't show remorse because he didn't do it. The original jury that heard the crime isn't there. I mean, it was in 1984. So he doesn't have access to the two strongest mitigators that there are. Let me tell you.
The same jury continues into the sentencing portion, right?
Ordinarily it would. But of course, time has gone by.
When did he sentence to death?
In 1984. So he's been on death row all that time. I'm going to tell you about one client of mine who, so you can sort of see how his life went and what I'm using for mitigation. His name his name that I'm going to give you is Raymond. It's not actually his name because I'm not sure about whether I should tell you his real name. I can tell you Leroy's name because he's been on the news a lot and is, you know, but Raymond, I'm not going to tell you his name. He was born in Jamaica of a 15-year-old mom in a very well-educated family that was well-established in Jamaica. And the family was ashamed that he was born, and so they sent the daughter away. But first she was allowed to nurse him for almost a year, and then quite abruptly they sent her away to London to finish her education. So he was taken from his mother's breast at age one and raised by his grandmother. His grandmother raised him on their farm in Jamaica until he was seven, and then his mother called for him in London, so he was sent to London to live with his mother and an aunt and uncle, two uncles, and of course his mother at that time was a perfect stranger. So then he was ripped from his grandmother's arms, who he was the only mother he'd ever known. During the first 7 years, his grandfather beat his grandmother, so there was violence in the home. And when he was five, one of the things he did was stop a beating of his grandmother by his grandfather by throwing a pot of soup on his grandfather, a boiling pot of soup, and then running like crazy to get away so he wouldn't get beaten up by the grandfather himself. That's a story I've heard from three different sources, so I believe it to be true. When Raymond got to London, he lived with his mother, who was a stranger and who was hostile toward him because he looked a lot like his father. And his father had been someone that she'd had an assignation with in the bushes, but had never dated and was not from a good family. And, you know, it was not someone that she looked back on with fondness. But the aunt and the two uncles liked him very much, and he got along splendidly with them, but not with the mother. He was very successful in school in London, he was so successful that at the end of his grammar school years, he was scholarshiped into the Westminster City Boys School in downtown London, which is a very prestigious private school where to which he wore, you know, a little navy jacket with gold buttons and a striped tie, and he went on the train every day to school, and he was doing splendidly. He was a wonderful student, and he was happy as could be. He was a black child in London, and I think that that could have caused some stress for him, but because he was a good student, it didn't seem to raise its ugly head. Maybe London is better than Chicago and things like that. So then he went to this Westminster City Boys School until his mother called him. His mother, at some point, decided to go back to Jamaica and start a business. So she left him with his aunt and his two uncles. So this is the third family now that he's lived with. They're very fond of him. He's very fond of them. The mother goes back to Jamaica. Then the mother decides a couple of years later that she wants her son in Jamaica. So there we go, off to Jamaica, where he lives on a dirt road with no electricity and walks, you know, 4 miles to school every day. But he got himself into a school in Jamaica, even though he was brought to Jamaica during the school year, not at the beginning or in the summer vacation, and started trying to make the best of life there. He was sad. There was no doubt that he was sad to leave London because he was doing well there. In Jamaica, his mother quickly decided that she didn't want him there, and so she went off to the United States. And he then was living with his grandmother, who he had lived with before. So there was connection there, and that was good. About a mile from their house in Jamaica for his first 7 years, and then again starting when he was 13 or 14, there was an enormous aluminum factory that was more than a mile square and around which nothing grew. And his house was part of the next circle out where some things could grow, but it wasn't as good as it was further out. The aluminum company provided a new roof for every house within 10 miles every year, a new zinc roof, because the corrosive effect of the fallout from the company was so great. So, and also water. They delivered water to all the houses because the water was not drinkable. My kid, however, has hypoglycemia. He gets terrible headaches whenever his blood sugar drops. And his uncle, his uncle in London has that, a great uncle in Jamaica has that. There's a history of it in the family. People pass out, including my client, when their blood sugar drops low enough. So he's constantly killing rabbits birds out in the countryside, lighting little fires, cooking it, and eating it, because he's out rambling all day long. Because there's this violence, remember the grandfather beats the grandmother, and so the home is unpleasant. So my kid goes to school, he feeds himself basically, he does a lot of hunting, he's eating stuff off this land, he plays in the dust, of course, he swam in the alligator pond, which is the nearby part of the ocean that the aluminum company was on. So I'm learning about all this aluminum, and I'm learning about the hypoglycemia and maybe the low serotonin levels in the brain, which helps you have self-control. Then, when he's 15, his mother, who's by now been living in the United States for 2 or 3 years, decides she wants her son. There's a surprise. There's a pattern here. So he gets called for, he gets moved to the United States, she moves him to a couple different neighborhoods, and then finally they settle in Evanston, which is the first suburb north of Chicago, and which has a very good high school. My kid, bless his heart, goes to ETHS, Evanston Township High School, joins the Caribbean Club, plays soccer, plays, you know, appropriate sports for every season, hooks up with a bunch of other Jamaican kids, gets into a little playing music on Friday night for parties deal, so that the white kids ask these Jamaican kids to come and be their their music player, you know, whatever it's called, where you jiggle the thing on the record and all that stuff. DJ. And so he's adjusting. And he gets on the honor roll in ETHS. And then the mother decides she doesn't like his friends, and because he stays out late on Friday nights DJing for these parties, which is his sort of entree in. And so in the middle of the school year, not at the beginning, not during summer vacation, but in the middle of the school year, she moves to a distant suburb with no other kids of color, no Jamaican kids, no Caribbean kids, too far away. And it's right before the prom. And he is his first girlfriend and has staged the prom. So he just loses it. He just can't, she doesn't tell him ahead of time. She hires the movers come, she gets him in the car, they're following the moving van, and they drive out of Evanston. And he goes, where are we going? And she tells him they're going to this distant suburb. So he completely went nuts. He just screamed, cried, kicked, the whole thing. And got to that suburb, got enrolled in the school, didn't study, flunked all of his tests, flunked out, joined a gang, and killed somebody. Got accused of a crime, got accused of killing someone. That's what we have to work with. Do you think, if you were the jury, would you want to kill him? He did the crime right after his 18th birthday. It was a crime of passion. He was part of a little gang of kids that had been ordered by the gang leader. It was the only way he could get acceptance in this suburb, was to join this gang. It was a multiracial gang. There were some Hispanic kids in it, some white kids in it, and he was the black kid in it. He was Jamaican. The gang leader got put in jail. He sent word out that the gang had to come up with $2,000. They had to steal it to bail the gang leader out. They devised this plan of going into a jewelry store. They went in the jewelry store and hit the jewelry repair shop, in the little repair shop, and in a little shopping mall in the suburb, and asked to see some jewelry. The guy put it on the counter. My guy tries to grab it. The repair guy goes like that. And my guy pulls a pipe out of his pants and hits the guy. Why it's a death penalty crime, there are 21 exacerbating circumstances, aggravations, that qualify you for death. A simple murder doesn't qualify you for death, but a murder with an aggravation qualifies you for death. And he was qualified in this case for death because he hit the guy over 20 times. The guy was dead after the second time, probably. But he killed the guy, and then he went around the counter and wailed on him. You know, he lost it. I mean, normally you would associate that kind of behavior with someone you hate that you're killing, or someone, you know, something, some emotional connection. There was no emotional connection, but something snapped. It happens that it was in the morning. He had not had breakfast, so that was the low blood sugar part of it, I think. It happens that there's some erosions in his brain from the aluminum, so that there's some lack of synapse connection and appropriate stuff in his brain. Somehow, this person had been nonviolent his entire life. He had this violent episode, and he's been nonviolent for the 3 years that he's been incarcerated since then. He doesn't have a single ticket in Cook County Jail. It's almost unheard of to be there 3 years and never get in trouble. Never get in trouble. He's a leader in the on the tier that he's on. He organizes the cleanup. He distributes food so that it's done fairly. He works in the high school in the jail, and he tutors, and he's a favorite of all the teachers. They give him extra responsibility. During the lockdown, every day at noon in the jail, he doesn't get locked down because the guards want to use him for cleaning or whatever, chores. But he has this one episode of completely irrational, stupid violence. And that's my case. I mean, that's a case of one pretty nice kid, pretty sweet kid. He's very good to me. He writes me thank you notes. He sends me cards. He has deep religious faith. We pray together regularly. We sing hymns. It happens that the room where I see him is in one of these dungeons with wet floor and dripping pipes and, you know. I don't know. What would you do with him? If you were a jury, would you want to kill him? Would you want to put him to death? I haven't done the outreach yet. I haven't gone to talk to the wife of the dead man. But I intend to. I intend to. I intend to listen to her and see what she has to say and have her get angry. I mean, I'll be the only face of the defense that she can talk to. So I'm going to see if she'll talk to me. And if she will, I'm just going to hope that she'll just vent and say how distraught and sad she is. And then I hope we can get to a place where we can talk about what would be healing for her. What would be the best outcome of this trial for her? And I'm just imagining that that might be a helpful conversation to have. It can't hurt, because the state is already asking for death. But if she could get to a place where she would say, this young man, whom I despise and hate and regret the existence of, won't help my grief by being put to death. And if she can say that to the state's attorney, I should think that would be a helpful thing. Maybe she's a Christian. I don't know. Maybe I can pray with her. I don't know.
Did you talk to his mother?
Oh, yes.
What do you think, Paul?
At length. I think she's completely bananas. It's a technical term. She's a fruitcake.
Does she feel that she bears any culpability in this because of pulling him at a vulnerable time?
She is so self-absorbed that it's really hard for all she...
She doesn't have the clue that she might have affected the outcome.
She will not go visit him on his birthday because she regrets his birth.
Oh, my gosh.
Was she living with people while she was moving, doing all this moving with another man?
She went through a number of boyfriends, and she moved. Most of her moves were because of boyfriends. But she's living alone now.
Now, can you share with the widow of the victim his story in order to influence her in any way, or are you not allowed to share that?
I am allowed to share that. I will do whatever she wants to hear. I wouldn't assume that she'd be interested in that story. I'd assume that she would like, the state tends to not pay much attention to the victim's family. So I would assume she's sort of, nobody tells her anything and she doesn't know what's going on. So I'll bring her whatever information I can bring her about this timing of the trial and the kinds of things that are happening and what the pre-trial motions have been and how they've been disposed of. But I mainly want to listen to her. I want to see how she's feeling, what does she have to say.
Now, the prosecutor wouldn't like you to be there, right?
No, that's true.
You are legally
I'm allowed. If she's willing to see me, I'm allowed to be there. If I call her, in my field, this mitigation specialist, there's a sort of debate about this. Should you surprise them and just show up? Or should you call ahead? Because if you call ahead, then they'll call the prosecutor, and the prosecutor will say, don't see them. Mm-hmm. But somehow I'm a Norwegian, you know. I feel like I can't just show up. It's too rude. So my inclination is to call and see if I can, and, you know, be prepared to go that day or the next day.
So the jury convicted him, though? The jury?
Not yet. Oh. He hasn't been tried yet.
I see.
Oh, for the crime?
Right.
Well, so you get this, you wouldn't use it if he were found out.
Yeah. But I would try not to do any harm along the way with the victim's family as well as with my client's family. And I try not to, I mean, if I do any work with the client's family, I try to do healing and reconciling work and encourage them to talk to each other and to go to the jail and visit him. Most people who are in this situation in jail, their families never come because they don't want to, it's too hard. They just don't want to think about it, so they don't. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I try to do is get people to go visit their loved one in jail.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The jury is not going to hear what you have to say until he's convicted and sentenced?
No, not sentenced. I mean, until he's convicted. You're exactly right.
Convicted.
If he's convicted.
But you already know that they're asking for the death penalty.
Yeah. The state has to declare.
Who called you in on this case?
The public defender.
Pardon?
A public defender.
Oh.
The capital crime unit of Cook County. Mm-hmm. The head of the capital crime unit calls me from time to time and says, do you have time for another case?
Are you independent?
Yeah, I am.
Don't you live that feeling? I mean, when you're investigating this, isn't that a part of your life then?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
what kind of support do you have through that whole process? And it sounds like it could be extremely difficult.
I was a college professor for 31 years, and college students will eat you alive if you let them. So I have good boundaries. The time that my boundaries fell down, interestingly enough, was Easter season during Lent. I was so aware this year that Jesus was condemned to death, and I really was carrying that death sentence daily with me, and I got more and more depressed. I couldn't figure out why I was so depressed. I mean, everybody would say, duh, you know, but suddenly it hit me. It was Lent. And I was going through this walk. And I also know that someone in my position has to be committed to a willingness to attend the death if it comes to that.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get someone to trust you and to share their life with you. And then when they ask you to come to their death, you can't say no. Mm-hmm. So,
they ask you to come to their death?
To people, I haven't had that happen yet because I haven't had anybody convicted, put to death. But people in my position who've been doing it longer than I have tell me that it will happen. And so I spend some time working on their faith life, even though I'm paid by the public defender's office, because I want to know what their ground of being is, and I want to strengthen their spiritual life if I have to walk those last weeks with them.
Five at a time.
Five
at a time. And always? Is it almost always that?
Well, no. I mean, I've only been doing it for a year and a half.
Oh.
So I have five, period. I have my five.
And none cases. Of them have so far been?
None of them I have four that are awaiting trial, and then I have Leroy, who has been on death row since 84, but he's been granted a new sentencing hearing. So
you've only had five cases?
Mm-hmm.
So won't you try and use the information you know in order to have him not be convicted? I mean, won't this information be presented then in the course of the trial?
Not relevant to the case, really. If I find out anything that's relevant to the case, like I told you about my 11-year-old.
It's only relevant to the sentencing, then, not whether you committed the crime or not. Then when you committed the crime.
Yeah, but what if you find out they didn't commit the crime or they did from all these stories?
Well, I certainly would share anything about the case that I thought was relevant to the case with the lawyers on the case.
And you're allowed to do that?
Oh, yeah. I'm expected to. And the lawyers and I are a team. We really work together. So I keep them posted on what I'm finding out regularly. Like in the case of this family that came out with the fact that the 11-year-old boy didn't do that murder. The aggravation in his case that qualifies him for death is that 11-year-old murder. The fact that he's murdered twice, once when he was 11, once when he was 18. And so I right away went to the lawyer with that and said, he didn't do the other murder. You know, now what we're going to do with that, I mean, she's trying to figure out the legal stuff around that because so he's already done the time, you know, and the cousin, do we want to, whatever. But I mean, why should a kid be put to death because his family made him cop to a crime when he was 11 that he didn't do? You know, I'm sorry.
Well, you asked the question, what would you do if you were on the jury? And I guess I personally have this thing that I've signed petitions, written the governor, done all sorts of things because I don't think any state should ever put anyone to death. But I don't know what one to do.
And you'd be excused from the jury?
I'm certainly would hope so.
But see, that's a problem, because everyone who will say in the jury selection process that they believe as you do will be automatically excluded from the jury. Automatically. They're not death qualified.
But if enough people can somehow, he asked the idea about the type changing. But it seems to me that what's happened over the years is the people who are sort of pro-death penalty have gotten their way. And if enough people say, this is wrong, we should not be doing this, and, you know, I'm not going to vote for you if you say you're pro-death penalty, maybe it'll make a difference.
Now, those of you who are at Bible study this morning, think about civil disobedience. You know, we really heard from the rabbi this morning about the importance of standing for justice. Maybe standing for justice in this case, I'm going to deny having said this. But maybe it's not telling when you're quizzed in the jury, not telling people that you're not death qualified. Because why should that side get their way so that all 12 jurors believe in the death penalty? What kind of a representation is that of the country?
I think as a juror, I would ask, this is what I would be saying in my own mind, what's to prevent hypoglycemia? This boy, sad as his life and his patterns have been, you know, what's to convince me that his patterns are going to be so much better and he's not going to have another hypoglycemic event and it's going to be my mom waiting for the bus and she's going to get clunked over the head and then pulverized.
He'd most likely get life in life.
Yeah.
In jail.
So he'd just be...
Yeah, that's about the sentencing bar. Because he committed the crime. I think it sounds like he's acknowledged that. So
he's death. He's already... If he's convicted, he's going to be put to death.
That's if he's convicted, then the question is to be determined. I mean, he could get life in jail, he could get 60 years.
I'm sorry, confusing Raymond and this gentleman here.
Right, Leroy.
Who is waiting for death.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to show you, I have a 10-minute video, 6:38. I have a 10-minute video about Leroy, this guy. Would you like to see it?
Yes.
Would you have fun to see it?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Put it on.
What magazine is he in? That's a journal of some sort.
This is a interesting piece that you might want to look at. It's called We on Death Row. It's a whole magazine of the stories of about 30 guys who are men and women who are on death row.
Where'd you get it?
I don't know.
I didn't see it in my newsstand.
Right.
It wasn't in Seattle.
So let's see if we can figure out how to do this, and then we'll have a few more minutes before. This is Bill Curtis, who's a news reporter who does A&E Arts and Entertainment.
Innocent of the crimes they were executed for. summoned the killer weren't called to testify. Grimm's court-appointed lawyer, Ron Mock, lost so many death penalty cases, the Texas death row was nicknamed the Mock Wing after him. Leo Jones was executed in Florida in 1998 for the murder of a police officer. Two policemen assigned to the case were later dismissed for ethical violations. More than a dozen people implicated another man. Roger Coleman was convicted of the rape murder of his sister-in-law in 1982. His attorneys were inexperienced. The evidence was tenuous, and he had an alibi. He was executed in 1996. January 2000, concerned that his state might execute an innocent person, Governor George Ryan of Illinois, well known for his pro-death penalty stance, made a groundbreaking announcement.
I now favor a moratorium because I have grave concerns about our state's shameful record of convicting innocent people and putting them on death row. I can't support a system which, in its administration, has proven to be so fraught with error and has come so close to the ultimate nightmare, the state's taking of innocent life.
It was a historic decision made not by a lawyer, but a former pharmacist.
Governor, you declared a moratorium on executions in Illinois. Why?
Well, it's a flawed system, Bill. The system that didn't work. We almost executed innocent people 13 times, as a matter of fact. And you know, I don't have to say this, it goes without saying, that we're going to have a system that's got to be perfect. Now, can we have a system that is? I don't know at this point.
To try to answer that question, Governor Ryan appointed a commission to study how fairly the death penalty was handed out in Illinois. Illinois is the only state that has a moratorium on executions. 15 other states considered moratoriums in 2001, but the arguments for them fell apart in the legislature.
It's been a very popular decision, it seems like. You know what's popular, Bill, is the fact that people want fairness and they want accuracy. It was just the right thing to do. How do you execute an innocent person? I mean, there's just no excuse for that.
The catalyst for Governor Ryan's call for a moratorium was the fact that 92 people had been freed from death rows across the country, 13 of them from Illinois. In 1998, Larry Marshall of Northwestern University School of Law, one of the warriors leading the charge for the wrongfully convicted, held a conference bringing together as many of those freed as he could.
Those people are all people.
My name is Walter Brown.
My name is Sonia Jacobs.
My name is Randall Dow Adams. My name is Kurt Bloodsworth.
The image of seeing the faces of 32 people who could have been executed in error was haunting. Marshall's center on wrongful convictions at the university was instrumental in getting 9 of them freed. Marshall and his staff at the center like to take cases where it's apparent justice has not prevailed. They believe the Leroy Orange case is that kind of case. It involves accusations of police misconduct and torture. Partners at Northwestern is the lead counsel on the case.
physical evidence that tied him to the event itself. There was evidence that he had been in that apartment, that he did know those people. I mean, that's how the police found him. I mean, his address book was found in the apartment. And Leroy doesn't deny that he knew the people who were murdered. He denies that he had anything to do with the crime.
There was also a phone call, the state's attorney says, Orange's stepbrother made, saying he and Orange had done something that could get them in serious trouble. And the most incriminating piece of evidence was a confession that Orange gave to police after his arrest at the Chicago Police Department's Area 2. The station would later become notorious for what happened there. Orange's description of the events that led up to that confession began when he was taken to an interrogation room.
And they kept asking questions about the residents not going to tell me anything. So they left out of the room. And I'm sitting there. The door opens, the hand comes to the door, takes the back switch off, and
plastic bag over my head. Unconsciousness.
His interrogation continued for 12 hours.
Sometime during the early morning hours, he started with his electrical business. Body being controlled by electricity. I recall after that thinking that I now know, uh-oh, a great victim, a woman of freedom. And then at that point, I decided to go along with.
Both Orange and his stepbrother were sentenced to death for the murders. For many years, as Orange awaited his execution day, he heard stories about other African-American men who said they'd been tortured into confessions at Area 2. In fact, there were 9 men, all on Illinois' death row, who had stories strikingly similar to Orange's.
There when they really worked me over, they punched and kicked me and put a plastic tie by the cover over my head and smothered me.
Leroy Orange was convicted of murder and sentenced to death based in part on that confession. He said he was tortured into giving. And then 9 other men said they were tortured into confessions at Area 2, and a pattern emerged. The combined accusations of 10 men strong enough to at least raise doubts, especially when they were on death row awaiting execution. Next on Investigative Reports, the Chicago Police Department looks into the death row 10's allegations of police torture.
Terry, one of my favorite.
I apologize, I made that recording myself. It's terrible, obviously. Did you understand what Leroy said?
Yes, thanks.
He's too shy to say much, but he was, electric electrodes in his rectum, and it was a whole series of things that were just awful. One of the things that I noticed about him when I started dealing with him was that his teeth were cracked, and I said, well, what is this about your teeth? And he said, well, you grind your teeth when you're being tortured. So that's one little piece of evidence that we now have. We've evidently it evaluated by a dentist and documented that it wasn't that way before. Also, you may have noticed there was a scar over his left eye. His mother threw a knife at him. She was a coke addict, and she threw a knife at him when he was 7. And the knife hit in his eye, and he was never taken to the doctor, and so it healed badly. So. So there's that little thing, but, you know, that would be mitigation in a case where if he were guilty, that would matter. But in this case, he's innocent, and so this piece of mitigation doesn't matter, but this one does. I know that it's time for us to quit. I did have one more thing I wanted to say. We have a war on crime going on in our country. I'm sure you're aware of that. And some people argue that collateral damage is innocent people being sent to death. To me, that's like saying a state or the federal government produces parachutes for a living, you know, to make money or something. And we sell them. And we say, oh, some percentage of these parachutes aren't going to work, like 5% or something of the people. Or in the case of Illinois, maybe 50% of the parachutes won't work, of people we sent to death. And so in those cases, oh well, whoever was depending on that parachute will die. It's just, to me, outrageous. Even if you believed in the death penalty, which of course I don't, that we would be so cavalier about human life. I think it is such a bad thing for us as a culture, as a people, as a civilization, that we use death as a tool to try to accomplish something. It doesn't accomplish what it sets out to accomplish. It is not effective in stopping crime. And it's a mistake so much of the time. We kill innocent people. So I hope that you'll think about civil disobedience and whatever other methods you can think of. We will talk a little bit tomorrow about things you can do. But tomorrow we will also focus on what our faith asks us to do about such things. Thank you very much for coming.